sense. My music is really across the board. Some of it's, you know, very meditative and calming and peaceful, and some of it's very in-your-face, aggressive and angry and emotional. And I run the gamut because as a person I run the gamut.
New music is misunderstood, says composer Alex Shapiro, because we're still using old labels to define new things. We'll be considering new music this hour through one of its more outspoken ambassadors, music that connects to the rhythms of sea creatures, Pacific currents, and current events. Alex Shapiro, an American music maker, coming up on Theme and Variations.
Theme and Variations is brought to you by the South Padre Island, Texas Convention and Visitors Bureau. The wide sandy beaches of South Padre Island will relax you, along with many exciting alternatives, including nearby Mexico. For more information, call 1-800-SO-PADRE or online at sopadre.com.
Additional support comes from the Texas Commission on the Arts and the Argosy Foundation. My name is Will Everett, welcoming you to a new monthly installment of our program, which we're calling American Music Makers. We've dealt with new music on this program before, most notably in our open forum broadcasts, but we've been nagged by the persistent thought that we should somehow try to dig deeper. For one thing, we had limited our subject to composers, which sort of implies people holding advanced degrees who write complicated music that no one listens to. What we needed was a definition that included all kinds of music makers, musicians, performers, and composers alike. When you address a topic that some call serious music, there's a tendency to look at new music in terms of legitimacy. For instance, is this something that will make the textbooks? Has it been recognized by the experts and given a category? I think we were all a little perplexed by the lexicon that invaded 20th century music, minimalist, serialist, modern, postmodern. The American Music Maker series will offer something different for this century, a look at new music from a cleaner, simpler angle. Is it really new? Is it different? And is it fun to listen to? In upcoming programs, you'll meet people like Chuck Wild, former keyboardist with the new wave band Missing Persons, who found his niche making music that literally puts you to sleep. We'll meet Becky Allen, who'll take us with her on a trip to West Africa, where she went for flute lessons. Or someone like Stuart Hines, who learned the art of Tuvan throat singing and can produce multiple melodic lines at the same time. Just try it. It's going to be a fun season. And we're debuting the series with someone who I think can give us probably our clearest statement of theme on this subject of new music. Alex Shapiro is a composer, guitarist, and sometime activist who invited me to her Malibu, California studio to talk about this thorny subject of new music. With Pacific waves beating on the rocks just a few hundred yards away, we didn't hang around the studio for long. You can't talk to an artist without talking about inspiration, and here it was all around us, the crashing surf, the tide pools, and teeming ocean creatures that whisper to the creative instincts of this New York-born composer. Ms. Shapiro has made a career of creating music that defies categorization. Much of her music is electroacoustic, and toward the end of our meeting, we'll visit the sophisticated computer arrangement in her studio where this complex music comes to fruition. But her music, I learned as we strolled along the beach, doesn't come from a computer. It comes from her own internal world, which has a great deal to do with resonance from the rhythms of nature. And yet she's no hermit on a hill. She's passionately involved in civil liberties, serving on the board of directors of the American Civil Liberties Union of Southern California in pursuit of First Amendment freedoms. She believes that for a composer to make meaningful music, that composer should have something to say. And Alex Shapiro has plenty to say, as we'll learn on this edition of American Music Makers. Stay with us. It goes without saying that if you want to understand something about a person, know something about the kind of music he or she listens to. To understand the music of a composer, it helps to understand the person behind the pencil, or in this case, the computer keyboard. Alex Shapiro has all the usual hallmarks of a top-caliber American composer: a Juilliard education, a prolific catalog of music for a wide array of acoustic and electroacoustic instruments. But you won't find her working in some red brick, ivy-choked university office. She left all that years ago and settled on the California coast. Her home is located outside of Malibu on a steep hill overlooking the sea. Alex has an infectious enthusiasm for what she does. That's the first thing I realized. We chatted in her home, where I got a quick tour of the studio and was introduced to her two cats, one white and one black, curled one beside the other like yin and yang. But we soon took our conversation outdoors, amid the wind and crashing waves of Alex Shapiro's spiritual home, where I began to wonder aloud about her composing technique, the role of technology, and her sources of inspiration.
What would you be doing if you didn't have a computer?
I'd be the old-fashioned way that I used to do until a few number of years ago, writing by hand.
Yeah.
And obviously not doing as much electronic music. I mean, I was doing electronic music back in the 70s when we were splicing tape, and it took a gazillion patch cords just to get a sine wave. And I was, because I started really young. I was 15 when I had my first electronic music classes in 1977 at the Manus College of Music summer course that I took. And so I got a pretty early start with modular synthesis. And I think about all the effort, and I stayed with it for a long time, and I think about all the effort it took to put together things that to my ear were not as expressive as I would like or weren't sounds that I was really that wild about. So if we were still doing that, I probably wouldn't be doing a lot of electronic music. What I have found using electronics, and especially because I do all my notation now on the computer in a program called Sibelius, what I found is that using, not having to hand copy things for the times when you do need a score, with some electronic pieces there is no score, but with acoustic music, chamber music, the notation can be very intricate and very time consuming, and if there are a lot of notes, it can really make your wrist tired. And I find that I'm a little bit more adventurous and thus more creative when I'm using computer copying, because I'm more likely to play with a passage or repeat something or delete something or move things around than I would be if I'd already slaved over copying out all those damn pages. I mean, I remember distinctly when I made the switch over to an entirely electronic notation palette, and it was in the year 2000, not that long ago, and I was writing that tuba sonata, Music for Two Big Instruments, which begins with a fair number of repeated notes on the piano. And by the 10th measure, I was just tired. My arm was tired, and I thought, I already know how this piece is going to go. I've kind of got it in my head, and I know how many notes are ahead, and I don't think I want to do this. And so that's when I decided I'm just going to write this right into Sibelius. Guys like Mozart, when you think of the reams and reams of material they wrote, and just, you know, and Beethoven, who made so many changes in his music, just how much their creative lives might have been improved if they had some of the tools that we have now. And of course, people 200 years from now are going to be saying the same thing about us. Look at these poor schlubs in 2005. Look what they had to do.
Yeah, they couldn't download the music straight from their
brains.
Exactly.
This is my great dream, of course. I think everybody must have the same wish list of, we just want a diode or some cable to plug right into our brain.
Oh, that's next.
That's next.
I know you probably take a lot of walks.
Yeah.
You probably get inspired.
We're on one that I take a lot, as a matter of fact, this one.
And I'm sure ideas come to you. How do you keep from losing those ideas? What do you?
If my theory is this, if I have noticed this at least in my own work, a lot of ideas do get lost, and usually the ones that get lost weren't that good to begin with. The ones that stick are the ones that end up, I think, being good. And I know this even from, let's say, I mentioned before, we were talking about the crickets, and I was talking about the pieces I was working on at McDowell. And, you know, this was 2 years ago. Well, materials that I wrote then, I'm finally bringing to fruition in this new piece for the quartet this next season. And the reason is because that material, I didn't do anything with it at the time, the particular stuff I had written for this one other piece, not the bioplasm piece, but the other. I didn't do anything with it. But it stuck in my head all these months later, years later. And that's when I know something has merit. If I'm continuing to be haunted by it, and if it's following me around, and if the idea really wants to be developed and come out, then I think it has merit. Then I think it's good, and other people are going to want to hear it.
So no pocket recorders, no notepad?
The only time I bring down a pocket recorder, and usually it's in the form of my cell phone, which has a voice message function on it, I'll be taking this walk often if I'm in the middle of a piece and I'm stuck and I can't figure out what next. And rather than bang my head against the desk or the computer or drink heavily, rather than that, I will just take a nice walk and clear my head and get away from the music problems and let my subconscious work on the problem while I work on, you know, the sea anemones and the sea urchins and the starfish. And often I'll bring my recorder, and 8 out of 10 times the problem will solve itself when I'm down at the beach. I don't think I'm the only person at all who's had this happen, where you wake up, for me it's usually in the early morning, and I wake up and I have just dreamed a very big swath of a completed piece. In every detail, every part, every orchestration, every nuance is there. And I wake up and for the life of me, I cannot recreate it. I cannot remember or notate the melody. All I know is in my heart of hearts, it was wonderful and it was original. And I say to myself, well, if you can dream it, it exists. And all you have to do is find the conduit within yourself in your conscious hours to be able to access that unconscious impulse. So I say to myself, if it's there, it's there. And it will come out in one form or another. So I just figure it's a sign that there's more inside me waiting to come out. When my inspiration is so tethered in a really organic and honest way to my living environment. And if you put me back in the middle of the city, I would like to think I would find other things that are organic to that experience that would come out in my music, but I suspect I wouldn't be as happy. Having grown up in the city, my first 21 years in Manhattan, I've turned into much more of a nature-based person. And the rhythms of the planet are more interesting to me now than the rhythms of the city are. And the space and expanse that we have kind of fill me in a very different way. than being in a city, which I find a bit oppressive now. So inspiration is what one resonates with, whatever that is for that person. Some people adore the city, and that's their inspiration, is that energy and all the sounds and smells that come from being in a city. And that's where they get their momentum. But for me, smelling the kelp, especially when it's foggy here, and the fog rolls in and you see these white, snowy wafts coming up, and they're filled with this thick, kelpy smell. And there, you can taste the salt on your lips like you can now from the spray, and it's just such a physical and sensual thing. And to me, that's what music is. It's physical and sensual, and it's all about sharing that sensuality with the listeners and bringing them into that experience, if you can.
When you're creating a piece of music, how much are you thinking about the listener, wondering, listener's not going to like this, I'd like to do it, but the listener's going to react negatively to this, so I'm not going to do it?
I would never think that in that way. The first part of the question is I think about the listener all the time, but never in terms of needing their approval, more in the opposite way of I want to please myself, and by doing so, I really do think a listener is going to enjoy this, as opposed to someone who only wants to please themselves and doesn't care at all whether listeners like it. I'm always thinking, well, if it does please me, if it's something that's memorable enough to me that I'm taking the time to write it down and I'm remembering it when I get up the next morning and all of this, if it's sticking with me, then I tend to think, well, it might very well resonate with someone else. I think ultimately if you are an artist, it means you have something personal to say, and so you don't want to be too reliant on pleasing other people. But by the same token, we have to earn the interest of our audiences. If we expect people to support our work, to buy our CDs, to buy our scores, to go to our concerts, to pay money to do these things, then we're sharing something it's something of value, and it has to be something of value to these other people. We can't just expect people to support it just because we deem it to be worthy. It has to connect with them emotionally.
To what extent do you think composers are out of sync with what people want to listen to?
Less and less so. And I think it's obviously a personal question for each composer. What I'm seeing in just the times we're in now is this wonderful opening up of so many diverse styles, so many diverse approaches to music, a complete blurring of the lines stylistically between what is edging toward pop and what is serious academic music and what is world music and what is jazz, and all of these lines are thankfully starting to go away. I think they really should go away, because music is music, and joy and communication and passion are all those things. They shouldn't be put in a box and categorized just because it's easier for DJs and record sellers to categorize them.
So if you're talking to somebody you're meeting for the first time, and you say, what do you call your music?
Well, I'll quote my dear friend Alvin Singleton, who's a wonderful composer. He's based in Atlanta. We were talking about this one day, and he looked at me and he said, well, when people ask me, what does your music sound like? I just tell them, it sounds wonderful. And you know, I think that's the perfect answer, because how do you describe something that's not tangible and that isn't tethered in a certain style, unless you really are a composer who writes in a very specific style where you can say, oh, I'm, you know, post-Babbitt, neoclassical, neo, you know, da-da-da. There's no way to describe it. My big crusade, one of my many crusades, I guess, in our new music world, is to break down these boundaries and barriers and descriptions. And one of the things I was saying earlier to you is that language is behind us. The music that's being created, there is no current description for it. There's no word we've stumbled across that really works, that describes it as its new thing. And so what's unfortunately happened is it gets tethered to something old. We call it neo-romantic or neo-classical or neo-this or neo-that. And that's terrible, because you're connecting something that's brand new with something of the past. And in fact, what is brand new is its own new tradition and its own new way of putting together harmonies and putting together influences. It really is its new thing. And I'm not sure a lot of people have wrapped their consciousness around that here in 2005, 2006, now we are actually, I feel strongly, in a new place in music and experiencing a whole new movement in music that it hasn't quite been identified as such because there is no good term for it, no good category, no place in the, no bin to put it in yet. Classical music, romantic music, baroque music, they didn't have those monikers at the time the music was being written. It was only after those periods that that they were called such. And we're in the same position now. Just as composers are responsible for promoting their work, we are the ambassadors, and the only good ones, really, for what we're doing. And we have to reach our audiences, and we have to bring them in, we have to earn their interest, we have to get them interested in what we're doing. Not by hitting them over the head and saying, this is good for you, you should enjoy it, eat your lima beans, you can't do that. But by just showing them, by example, creating environments where they can enjoy this music and be open to it and stop being so afraid of what's going on. And that's also true for the more thorny and challenging things, of which I write plenty of more thorny and challenging things. My music is really across the board. Some of it's, you know, very meditative and calming and peaceful, and some of it's very in-your-face, aggressive and angry and emotional. And I run the gamut because as a person I run the gamut. And I want to share that entire gamut of emotions with listeners.
Tell me about a short piece that you have that's thorny and aggressive.
Well, I'd say the opening movement to a piece for piano and two percussionists called At the Abyss. It would be described as that. It has a middle section that's just basically melancholy and not so thorny, but the opening is just a loud whap, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, whap. And it's very loud and it's very... distinctive in its statement. And basically the statement behind it is, pay attention, something is wrong. Is in three movements, and the first movement is called Observe, and the second movement is called Reflect, and the third movement is Act. And it pretty much is a representation of the way I feel about the world around us. This is a somewhat political piece. It was written, as many pieces were, in the wake of 9/11, about a year after that, and I was just looking, it wasn't about 9/11, that's almost trite at this point, but it was more about the disintegration on many levels of what I feel is our government here in the United States, and a lot of unpleasant things going on in the world, and just the way human beings do not seem to be evolving at the rate that I would like them to evolve if I were running the world. And so I wrote this piece where the first statement is, pay attention, there's something wrong here. And then, of course, after you have that emotion, the next thing is, wow, you start thinking about it. And that's a very meditative, quiet, very, very quiet movement. Next one is, hopefully you can do something about things in one way or the other, and that's ACT. So that's an example. you had asked me earlier what were the non-musical activities that I liked, and at first I talked about the nature-based ones. You know, I'm a certified sailor. We live on a sailboat part of the time and every week, and I love ocean kayaking. It's a great pleasure of mine to be beak level with the pelicans, and it's just downhill skiing when I get the chance. But on the flip side of that, I'm also somewhat political and have been deeply involved in civil liberties work in the past. Not as much anymore. I've been I've just been really busy with music and I haven't had as much time to devote to civic issues. But in the 90s, I was very, very active. I was on the board for a number of years of the American Civil Liberties Union of Southern California, and I was vice president of that 30,000 member affiliate for a couple of years, and chair of the state and national legislative action committee. So not things you would expect a composer to be doing, but it kind of shows that anybody can care about the Bill of Rights. You don't have to be a lawyer to care about the Constitution and to be somewhat well-versed in that subject. But that was a very wonderful and balancing time for me as a musician. At the time, I was working in commercial media. I was doing low-budget film and TV scoring, and that was my passion and my career. But doing these other things in the community were just marvelous, marvelous experiences for me, working on issues that I cared about so passionately and seeing that balance between the passion of those issues and the passion in my music. I mean, passion is passion, wherever you find it. So I always say to younger composers, emerging composers, get involved, whatever the thing is. And it doesn't have to be political. It could be anything, but do something that's not music in your life. Balance yourself out, because ultimately our music comes from our personhood. If you have to have something to say as a human being, whatever that is to you, there are no rules. It can be anything. I love chocolate ice cream. It can be that. Whatever you want to say. But have something to say. And that comes from life experience. And we don't get life experience holing up in our studios, writing, 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 writing. I mean, yes, we should be doing a fair amount of writing, writing, writing. And that's what we do. But we have to live, live, live. And we have to interact. And we have to feel. And we have to be hurt. And we have to be joyous. And everything in between. We have to be pissed off, which is easy to do when you turn off the TV these days or read the news on the internet. And that's where I think the best of our music is going to come from, is from being human.
Listening to Conversations with Alex Shapiro, an American music maker, on Theme and Variations. We talked about what it means to be a composer of new music in an industry that really doesn't have a name for the kind of music Alex creates. We talked about her sources of inspiration, her technique, the future of new music, and how composers shouldn't hole up in their studios all the time, but should let their passion for something non-musical stimulate their musical passions. And then she mentioned a recent project that she was clearly passionate about, a collaboration with a musician she never met.
When we were talking about collaboration, like what I call fixed collaboration, where someone has given you material to work with, you might think ahead of time, thinking about the material, oh, here are all these really cool things I'm going to do with it. And they might be intellectually just wonderful ideas. I mean, sound great at the time. But then you get the material, and you listen to it, and it tells you really where it needs to go. It has its own essence. And what you had thought before, perhaps, of how you were going to shift and mold that essence ends up really not being the case. And one case in point is this that I just experienced. I was very fortunate to be contacted out of the blue last year by a 32-string veena player in Delhi, India. His name is Thakur Chakrapani Singh. He is a master player, he's a wonderful instrumentalist, and from what I can tell from our emails, a lovely person. We have not spoken on the phone yet, and we haven't met. But he had contacted me, having heard some of my music, and wanting to collaborate. And I thought to myself, well, gee, how do you collaborate with someone who's many, many thousands of miles away, and you're not planning on being there anytime soon? How is this going to work? And I told him about an album I was currently starting that is a collection of electroacoustic pieces where I feature one soloist against a pre-recorded electronic soundscape that I create. This was a new thought, a new opportunity. I wrote to him back and I said, well, if you would like to send me some of your ragas, very cleanly recorded, and allow me to set them almost like poetry, allow me to work with them, I would be certainly delighted. And 2 weeks later in the mail, I got a CD from the fellow that was just beautiful. It was so beautifully recorded, and it featured four different tracks, two with tabla, two without, and I was very inspired. So I set out first to create a roadmap, if you will, rather than take one of his ragas straight through. I did play around a little bit with the order of things and dovetailed some of the parts that didn't have tabla with some of the parts that did, and you know, just kind of created a new whole out of it. And then I set about orchestrating it in a very subtle way, not one that would impose hugely my sensibilities on it, but rather that would bolster his Eastern sensibilities with some Western sensibilities. And I'm very distinctly American, I think, in a lot of what I do. He is certainly a very distinctly North Indian composer and player, although I hear Western influences strongly in his work. So I added not only electronic tracks, but I also picked up my guitar, since I'm a guitarist, and I added some guitar tracks in the latter part of the piece that I did for him. And I think the resulting piece, called Chakra Suite, which I titled partially in honor of him, because his name is Chakrapani, but also because the form of the music is a suite form, sort of connected modules. And I'm pleased with how it turned out.
Here it is in its entirety, the Chakra Suite for 32-string Veena and electroacoustics, featuring Thakur Chakrapani Singh on Veena from the new CD Alextronica by Alex Shapiro. That's the Chakra Suite, music by Alex Shapiro in collaboration with Veena player Thakur Chakrapani Singh. Now that I was familiar with Alex's electroacoustic creations, I wanted to know more about what she'd done for more conventional instrumental arrangements. In fact, it was a chamber work that had initially turned me on to her music, a string quintet called Current Events.
Current Events is a string quintet that I wrote in 2003, and I was given a blank slate. I mean, it just it was a commission from a wonderful concert series out here in Los Angeles called Pacific Serenades, which commissions four new works every year for each one of their concerts, and it's really unique in that way. And all I was given as a palette was, here are your four instruments. I mean, he had asked me, in general, what would I like? I had mentioned string quartet, and then he called me back and he said, how about a string quintet? Never one to turn down an extra instrument. I said, sure. And so I knew I'd have two violins, two violas, and a cello, and that's all I knew. I knew I'd have about 15 minutes of time, whatever I wanted to do with it, and there was absolutely no program dictated other than that. But I'd been living here, right, I'd been living in Malibu for about 12 years by then, but I'd been living right here on the beach for a couple of years, and I had become so aware of how much the rhythms of the ocean, is what we're hearing behind us, and also the depth of life in the tide pools that I love so much and spend so much time at, were affecting me on a very deep and subtle way. I mean, it wasn't just an outward thing. It was just something that had become a very inherent part of my life, my daily life. And I thought, I was at the tide pools one day and just watching the ebb and flood, and watching the life get exposed in the tide pools every time the water would pull away. And I was looking at the vulnerability of these little creatures, especially as the sun would bake down on them, and they can only sustain so much sunlight before they dry up and die. And I was wondering, gee, do they have a sense of when they're going to be covered up again? And I was just starting to get into this whole rhythm of what it's like to be a sea urchin, or what it's like to be a little squid. And I was thinking also about some of the amazing storms I had seen recently, and the surges that come up onto the shore, and just how it completely erodes and changes the beach, and that the beach is never the same way twice. I walk down here almost every day, it always looks different. And the horizon of the ocean always looks different because of the quality of the light. And so somehow this became very musical to me, and I thought, if I don't want it to be a completely programmatic, you know, let's tell a story kind of music, but I wanted to somehow reflect the surge of the tide and the unexpected excitement and ominous quality of that, because you never know how much damage it's going to do. And I wanted to explore the introspective nature of those naked tide pools and the vulnerability that they experience. And I wanted to explore kind of the panic of a riptide and when you're caught in it, and kind of knowing that, gee, if you just go along with it and don't fight it, you'll probably be okay. And so that music sort of turns out that way. It goes from being tense to being calmer and happier. Thank you.
That was the third movement of Current Events, a string quintet by Alex Shapiro. We've been walking among the rocks and trails outside of the composer's home near Malibu, California. As afternoon turns into early evening, the wind grows perceptibly cooler, and we retreat indoors for a tour of her studio. I suppose I shouldn't have expected musty music books and ink-stained work tables. What I found was something off the set of Star Wars, a sort of high-tech cockpit with multiple computer screens, keyboards, and mixers, all arranged in a neat arc around the composer's chair. Guitars stood nearby. I asked her to call up some of her electroacoustic effects on the computer.
Change your envelope with the filters and completely adjust the sounds as well. I mean, it's endless. That's a beautiful sound, actually. I've never used that one. Next piece. And the crowd are loving it.
The crowd goes wild. How do you get any work done when it's this much fun?
It is this much fun, and that's why I get so much work done, because it's akin to candy shop.
Outside, through the windows of the studio, the sun had set. Time to be moving on. But I remembered that Alex is a guitarist, and I couldn't leave without hearing something on guitar. She played what she called one of her oldest compositions, and toward the end of the piece, one of her cats jumped up on her work table and sang right into my microphone. Smudge on vocals. Smudge, someone has to tell you there was no vocal part written into this. We've been spending this hour in the company of musician and composer Alex Shapiro on an American Music Maker broadcast of Theme and Variations. To learn more about her music, visit her website, alexshapiro.org. You'll love her essays. Alex is the first of many American music makers we hope to visit in this series. in an effort to help define new music and meet the artists who are giving life to this vigorous but sometimes marginalized genre. We are supported in this effort by a grant from the Argosy Foundation and by the South Padre Island, Texas Convention and Visitors Bureau, online at sopadre.com. For more information about this program, including our current broadcast schedule, visit treehouseproductions.org. Our address is P.O. Box 3699, South Padre Island, Texas, 78597. Once again, that's P.O. Box 3699, South Padre Island, Texas, 78597. This is Will Everett for American Music Makers and Theme and Variations. We'll see you next time. Thanks for joining us. This has been a creation of Treehouse Productions.